This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Scotland Outdoors podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Oh, what a beautiful day. I've got that glorious feeling. Everything's going my way.
Hello, and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you know, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
This week, you had to call in pest control. Mm-hmm. So prepare yourself for some epic rat facts.
Out of Doors with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
I came out of the house at 5:10 this morning, and there was light in the sky. Light in the sky, I tell you. Ah, it was frost in the windshield too, but that's neither here nor there. And down south, all the sort of blackthorns out in blossom. It's lovely. Good morning, I'm Mark Stephen. The other side of the fire here at Beechgrove in Aberdeen, Rachel Stewart.
You know, you mentioned that last week that you've got a daffodil that's out that you call the gipe.
Yes.
We've got one
daft
as well. Daff gipe. We've got one as well, so it must have come out in sympathy.
Yes.
It's a gorgeous morning, actually, and I think there's sun in the forecast here anyway. Mm-hmm. And it just puts a spring in your step, doesn't it, to get out and it's light. Because for months we drive to work in the dark.
In the gloom.
Today I can see you again.
Yeah, it's not necessarily all good news then, really, is it?
Get in touch and let us know what you're up to today. What are your plans? You can email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, or you can give us a ring on 0808 592 9500. Now, to the all-important matter of the mystery sound. Let's have our first blast of the day.
Somebody with a bit of polystyrene in the mirror, I suspect.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I like that. Get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295, or it's Owen here this morning on 0808 592 9500.
Now, here's something we don't receive every week in Out of Doors. It's a birthday shout-out. This comes from Jane, who says, could I please request a birthday hello to the man who introduced me to Out of Doors, my brother-in-law, Graham. He gets up every Saturday to listen to my sister down in Hove with breakfast in bed. It brings him closer to his Aberdeenshire heritage. We've heard many funny stories of childhood drives north with his three siblings and his parents' tag team driving with no stops. It was the 1970s. It's to visit his grandparents in Montrose. He used to pile us all into the back seat. Mm-hmm. And the pram was balanced on the parcel shelf at the back. Can't help thinking they just wanted to get out of that car as quickly as possible, he says.
Graham introduced me to the podcast, which transports me to such a happy place. I keep searching for my Scottish ancestry. Please could you say happy birthday, and a little part of me wants to check he really is up listening in bed at 6:30 on a Saturday morning. That's it, according to Jane. So, Graham, this is our, your
happy
mission.
Happy birthday to you.
Well, we'll not inflict that on you. But can you just give us a wee text or an email to prove
just
that you're up and about?
That you are up. That's what we're asking for. It's not much to ask, I think, under the circumstances. When I was a boy, I was fascinated by the works of Gerald Durrell. You know, I read all the books, etc., My Family and Other Animals. You know, the fact that he founded a zoo, I just loved it. The charity that currently bears his name, Durrell Conservation, has recently taken on the lease of a Highland Perthshire estate. Now, this is a completely new thing for them, and it's at very early stages, as I found out when I met Durrell's programme director for Scotland, Deirdre Stewart.
Down the Cardiff represents a typical Highland Perthshire landscape, shaped by many influences over time, livestock, deer, and sporting use. We're fully within the Cairngorms National Park. The estate is primarily upland, open moorland, a significant amount of peatland, Some small pockets of native woodland and some commercial woodland as well at the bottom end. We're bounded on the west side by the A9 trunk road, and then to the east, a number of neighbouring estates.
If I stand here on the top of the track here and just look around, they're not high hills that I can see, but you know the cloud cover's quite low, so there could be big stuff out there that I'm unaware of. But it's moorland, it's heather, it's scrubby grass, it's deer grass. There is a burn or a large river running down through that. Very, very few trees here. What actually lives on here at the moment?
It is quite a high piece of ground, actually. There's Munros at the top. So we've got red deer, obviously, black grouse, merlin. We'll have golden eagles here, red grouse, dotterel. So a rich variety of bird species from down into the shelter of the glens there where the burns run right up to the top of the hill.
And what is it you want to do here?
So I look at the changes that we might want to deliver here in certain ways. I think we need to understand what we've got, maybe what we don't have, and what would we like. And to consider those different parameters, we need to start with baselining and clear ecological studies for flora and fauna, and understanding what we have here and their status.
When you look at this, what do you see?
First and foremost, I see my comfort zone. I see my workplace. And I see the opportunity and the resource here and how we can improve that, or the things we can do to keep it in the best condition, and how it can contribute to wider issues such as flood mitigation, water quality. That's what I see here.
And notice you don't use the word rewilding. Rewilding is such a common term nowadays, it's kind of making my teeth itch.
I think that we are all finding our way in identifying exactly what that means and where. I think there's actually quite a broad alignment in what a lot of estates are doing in terms of what rewilding is, and whether that's woodland creation or peatland restoration. All those things really, to me, seem to fall within that rewilding category in terms of activity.
How are you going to do what you want to do? How are you going to implement that?
I think that's going to be a long process. We have a lease here for 100 years, and it will be a measured process. We've got a lot of things to have to consider here. So I think there'll be an appropriate pace of change in how we deliver that and how we deliver those objectives.
Looking around here, I mean, we've just walked past a ruined cottage there. There's another one there. I suspect that's a chimney breast I can see sticking up, although it looks like an odd sort of cairn. The one thing you don't see in this landscape is people. Are you going to put people back in the landscape?
I think you'd be surprised. I think a day like today, you might not see so many folk. This is a right of way, and it's a very popular access route through the Gaic Pass into Struss Bay. So in terms of access users, it's a popular space.
I think I was talking about people living
absolutely.
In this.
Absolutely. You know? So I think that's a long-term aspiration, that whether we see people living right up here in the glen, or whether we can support them economically with our activities, I think that's perhaps maybe more of a realistic ambition for us to have here.
Say you decide you're going to put more trees across this. You've got 18,500 acres here, but deer haven't got maps. They've no idea where the boundary line is. How are you going to protect those trees?
So there will be different measures that we can consider in order to establish woodland. And the first thing there that we have to be realistic about is, where can woodland realistically be established and where can it grow in the appropriate place? How you manage deer? Well, we will use different tools available to us in terms of management or fencing. Obviously, close liaison with our neighbours is also a really important thing there, and how we deliver the appropriate and responsible deer management.
But you've worked in a shooting estate before. You know how this operates. If you lower the number of deer here, you create a vacuum, and the deer start to leave the surrounding estates and come into yours, because there's more space here, there's more food here. That's not going to go down well.
I think that as a land manager responsible for deer management, It would be very ignorant for me to think about just the four walls of my estate that I work on, and deer are across that whole range, and that's how we have to manage them within their whole range.
You don't own it outright. You've got it as a lease, etc. You have neighbours who are going to be affected by what you do, etc. It's going to be a serious balancing act.
I think for me, Mark, that is definitely the opportunity. You know, and I think for my involvement here, that's what I want to see happen, is to try to support those changes, keep those valuable relations with neighbouring estates, with other people that are directly and indirectly interdependent on our activities here. There's perhaps a change and transition in there, but I think that can be done sensitively.
Have you any clear idea at the moment what this surrounding area is going to look like? What this estate's going to look like in 100 years' time? How would it be different from what I can see now?
I think how it will initially be different will be because of tree cover and a variety of habitats. There'll be a greater diversity of habitats. That would be the primary difference. I think, like you said, you don't see many people here. I would like to see more people here, enjoying the environment, learning from the environment. So those might be the two principal changes.
Working in the environment?
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. One of the reasons that I came to this post was because of my ambition to try to help support education in this field, in land use and in land management. And that's something which is really important to Durrell to deliver on site as part of their field programmes. So whether that's connections with academic institutions, with local schools, PhDs, master's students, whatever, I would like to see that Dal na Cardach can in some way contribute to their learning and support that.
Deirdre Stewart there, Programme Director for Scotland at Durrell. Now, it's an interesting project. We'll have to see how it turns out.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you will probably have noticed this. A few weeks ago, Mountaineering Scotland appointed two women as president and chair of their organisation. It was in the news quite a bit because it's the first time that females have held those roles. Now, the pair in question are Anne Butler and Jo Deitch, and I suppose, as you'd expect, they're enthusiastic ambassadors of hill walking. And Anne's very clear on this. She says it's something that's completely transformed her life, actually. I joined them on a walk up Glen Tilt and asked Anne a bit about why she thinks some women are still reluctant to get out there and give it a go.
Well, I think a lot of women lack confidence. I mean, women, and it's very generalising here, but women are usually slightly more risk averse and a lot more cautious about an activity. And if you have never done it before, and particularly women of a certain age, you may have brought up children, not had a career, and you want to do something for yourself, you've got that time for yourself, it's very difficult to know where to start. Now, I started later on in life. You know, I wasn't lucky like Jo that had parents that sort of, you know, nurtured me into the hills. And it was a massive learning curve. You needed to know so much to keep you safe and to give you the confidence to do that. And I think when you look at social media, I mean, I find it quite off-putting sometimes that there's so many absolutely sylph-like women that are at the top of a hill. They've got not an ounce of sweat on them. Their hair's...
We're just pulling into the side because a van's about to pop past us.
These women look absolutely stunning. Now, in reality, none of us look like that at the top of a hill. And I think if you think, you know, these women have got there, they've run to the top... That's something that you might feel slightly off-putting, think I'm not fit enough, I haven't got the experience enough. But I can honestly say that I haven't got to a hill yet where I haven't got to the top and collapsed in a sweaty heap going, phew, I'm glad I'm there now. It's hard work.
It is hard work.
It is hard
and,
work.
And you don't
have to be
an athlete,
to do it. And that's what I really want to get across. The hills are there for everybody. Luckily, with Mountaineering Scotland, if women feel that they're not confident to go out walking with a group of men, or they feel that they're uncomfortable in a learning situation with a group of men, Mountaineering Scotland run female-only courses in navigation, winter skills, climbing. So, you know, that's there, where women are in an environment where the role model's there. The people taking the courses are women, you know, professional outdoor women leaders. And it's to show, you know, I think if there aren't any role models in existence, you know, women have got no one to look up to and say, well, you know, if that person's done it and they've got from, you know, an office-based career to running their own mountain guiding business, or this person who's she doesn't look like a natural athlete, but she's made it up a lot of hills and thoroughly enjoyed it. I think that's the message I really want to get across. And just really saying to women that there really are no barriers. You've got to just have the confidence to say, I'll give it a go. And as Joe said, come up for a walk on a forest track. Enjoy being outdoors. Get used to being cold and wet, because that's what hill walking's about. You're going to spend a lot of time getting cold and wet. Now, don't feel that you've got to climb a Munro. Exhaust yourself. Put yourself off. Don't enjoy it, and that's it. You say, oh, I didn't really like that, it's not for me. You know, build up gradually, and you really will. It'll open such a lot of doors.
Is there a variety of people from different socio-economic backgrounds using our hills and Munros? Or does it tend to attract the well-heeled? Because, you know, a lot of the gear that you see, particularly advertised in magazines, glossy magazines, is really expensive.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's definitely changing, thankfully. But I think if you look back on the kind of main demographic of mountaineering and hill walking in this country, it would probably be a slightly higher socioeconomic group, but it's definitely changing. And I think that is probably one misperception and a potential barrier to entry that people think, oh, to be able to start hill walking. So let's say hill walking rather than mountaineering, to start hill walking, I have to have all this fancy kit, and you definitely don't. I think you've got to make sure that wherever you're going and the weather that you're going out in, you're properly equipped, for sure. And there's definitely certain things that I would say, and you can find all of this on our website, that you should be carrying in your bag with you, because you never know what's going to happen, so you should be prepared. But really, you need a good windproof, waterproof jacket and a good pair of boots that you're comfortable in, as long as it's not going to be horrendous weather.
So that's maybe a map and a compass and not just your mobile phone.
Yeah, and that's actually a really interesting one as well. And we've done some stuff recently around Smart Nav, because a lot of people are taking to tech to navigate now, as we are, you know, across lots of our life, pieces of our life. But yes, we would always recommend a map and a compass if you are, as a backup, if you do want to use your mobile phone. And again, on that, there's lots of stuff on our website, and with the navigation side of things, that's a barrier to entry. And honestly, I'm really not very good at navigating, and it's always been a blind spot for me, but I'm trying, and I'm trying to learn and get better. And I don't know if it's a personal thing. I think it's worse than it is. But we do lots of courses, like Anne said, around navigation, summer and winter, and that's a really good place to start. But yeah, you don't need lots of fancy kit. And also, what I would say is, you know, you can always borrow. If you know someone that might have a jacket you can borrow before you go and spend lots of money on one, that's maybe a good idea too.
I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of snobbery around gear. You know, we see all the mountain professionals dripping with labels. You know, it's got to be mountain equipment, or, you know, Architrex or Rab, or, you know, things that, like you said, cost hundreds and hundreds of pounds. Where there are shops where you can get perfectly good, you know, jackets that will keep you dry, will keep you warm. It doesn't matter. As long as they do the job, it doesn't matter what the label is. You know, go and buy something in Mountain Warehouse that's going to keep you warm and dry while you walk up Mealer Buckle or Craigellachie in Avonmore. Don't worry about spending £300. You can spend a small fortune on hill walking, but a lot of the stuff, you know, if you've got a pair of some decent footwear for out for walking your dog, that'll see you up, you know, the sort of forest tracks that we're walking on now. It'll see you up some of the lower hills and what have you. Again, there's plenty of Facebook pages that sell second-hand gear, people looking to exchange gear. And you can pick up some magnificent bargains on that without feeling that, you know, because you can't go in and spend £500 on boots and a jacket, that's a barrier. You know, and maybe we need to share that more and sort of, you know, bookmark these sites where people can look if they are feeling that that's a barrier to them getting out and about.
Anne Butler and Joe Deitch there, and you can hear more on their thoughts in the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available on BBC Sound.
I listened to the podcast, thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's really interesting hearing those views, because I think it's fair to say that, you know, way back when it was, you know, the drift ethos of it was, you know, pretty roughy toughy and blah 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 and what have you, and they're saying no, it doesn't entirely have to be about that. There's a whole range of experience here, and it all benefits.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the clothing thing's interesting as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you think back 20 years, probably nothing looked particularly cool. You know, people were not breaking their necks to wear this kind of thing.
No.
But actually, a lot of this gear's become quite fashionable. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's become pretty expensive as well.
Well, when I started wandering about in the hills, I mean, there wasn't that kind of poor stuff. I mean, or rather, not that it was anywhere near affordable for me, so it was like the Army and Navy stores. And it astonished me that anybody survived in the Army at all, because almost invariably it was rubbish, you know?
And you get very wet.
Aye, quite. Yeah. Anyway, you're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, she's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, life on Mars, and I have rats in my stable. Not bats in my belfry, but rats in my stable, and that's not a euphemism. Stay tuned for some fascinating facts on what is a much maligned creature.
I was a bit concerned that you might have rats in your kitchen. And who would you phone if that was the case?
Ghostbusters.
I was thinking you'd be 40, but please yourself. We've also got a mystery.
I missed that one, sorry.
We've also got a mystery sign for you today. Have another listen. Ian and Tully Nessel's been in touch. He said, is today's mystery sound a golden eye? Good guess.
Good guess, David John Chadwick. Luke basically says, we're taking the dogs out for a brief walk prior to travelling down to Pitlochry and a visit to Rami's Bakery for rolls and bread. It says, I think the mystery sound is a waterfall. Good guess.
Denise, Phil and Reggie, the lab, have been in touch. It's a bright but chilly start to the day here in Rothes. A day full of promise. Is the mystery sound a duck call whistle in need of some WD-40? A paddle in the River Spey beckons for ourselves and Reggie, the black lab, this morning.
I don't know if you can hear that in the background. We've got a woodpecker in the tree, literally just across the other side of the wall. And it's making some good noises.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Get in touch if you want to have a guess on our mystery sound, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or give us a ring on 0885 92 9500.
Last week, I went to visit a project that's been looking back in time at our rivers to try and get to grips with how we used to do things to inform how we might do things in the future. The Catron Eco Museum got National Lottery funding to carry out a year-long project titled The River Detectives. Now, I met up with volunteer Gordon Miller, along with project leaders Christopher Dingwall and Dr. Richard Tipping.
The project is really about understanding the history of Strathmore, that area between St. Blair Gowrie and Forfar. So the idea is to explore the 18th and 19th centuries. These are the times when our landscape was changed almost entirely. Nothing before then survived beyond them. So we're digging into the past, and we're using historical techniques sometimes, and sometimes we're using scientific techniques to try and uncover the story of Strathmore over those turbulent centuries.
One of the things you've been looking at, Christopher, is something called marl. Now, what is marl and how was it used?
Marl is, it's a geological term for, in this case, that we're talking about stuff called shell marl. And this accumulated in lochs and bogs really after the last ice age. And it was made up, this shell marl, as the name suggests, of the shells of small mollusks. And they took the lime out of the water, if you like, for their shells, and then when they died, sank to the bottom of these lochs. So in the early 18th century, so we're talking about 1730s, 1740s, a number of the landowners in Strathmore realised that this stuff could actually be used as a fertiliser. So they set about either dredging the lochs to get at this material or actually digging under peat bogs and things, because some of the wee lochs where the stuff accumulated, they could find the marl underneath that.
What does marl look like? Do you dig it out?
Well, it can either be like a sort of silt almost, or a crumbly material that when you dredged it out of the lochs or dug it from under your fields, you could spread it out in heaps, let it dry out, let the water dry out from it, and then it was just there as a sort of natural fertiliser.
You can see farmers nowadays, you know, with these big lime spreaders out in the field and these great plumes of lime out behind it. It's exactly the same thing. It's trying to change the pH of the soil and basically sweeten the soil.
That's right. And what happened really was that there was a big industry and there were big estates like, say, the Earl of Strathmore, for example, at Glamis, where they were, the estate realised that not only did they have this material to spread on their own fields, but they could actually sell the stuff. So it became an industry.
That nobody remembers at all nowadays.
Which lasted maybe less than 100 years, really, and by 1830s, it was dying out, partly, I think, because the marl was difficult to get at. It was a messy business. But also, there were other ways of fertilising your fields. The railways arrived. You could import fertilisers that way. So it died out. And as you're saying, it was forgotten about.
Gordon, you're a volunteer in this. What have you been doing?
I've been down doing the boreholes with Richard, where we've been taking out samples from the old river sections to see if we can actually look at the stratification of those floods and date them. I've also been working on some of the mapping of the area around Meagle and looking at really trying to rebuild the history of the place on paper, right from prehistoric all the way through to modern, where we've been using the areas that we can identify to then work out the blank areas must have been where the moss was. So what's quite amazing is when you relive how it was, the whole area around Glamis up towards Meagle, that whole area was a big moss. And now it's beautiful countryside and agricultural land, and it's because of the Marl Revolution changed all of that. You had the Scottish Improvement. So we're kind of living through piece by piece what happened in the area.
We're standing beside the River Tay at the moment, yes. And because there are more frequent extreme weather events, etc., yes. In the wintertime it's going up and down like a fiddler's elbow.
Yes.
The research that you are doing on old floods,
yes.
Can it be used in any way to inform possibly future events or, how we could cope with things?
We're hoping so. So what we've got is a wonderful data set from 1800 somewhere to the modern times, and we are looking for those patterns and those things. It's early days. We've got to do a lot more work on the data. We've got to argue between ourselves as to what we're looking at. But yes, the hope is then we can actually look at that and say, this weather type in this area, we might expect a flood.
Citizen science, Christopher. I mean, essentially, you are the experts, and people are, civilians are coming to you and, they're being steered in the right direction. They're learning from you. Do you ever learn from them?
Oh, absolutely, yes, because they come in with different skills from mine. I mean, I may be a landscape historian, I might describe myself as. I've spent a good 30 years or more researching historic landscapes. But what the local recruits, if you like, come in with is their special knowledge of the area. You'll gather from my accent that I'm not local, although I've lived here for 40-something years and become fairly well ingrained in the landscape. It's not quite the same as having the real local knowledge.
Can I ask you what might be a slightly sensitive question? Demographics of the volunteers. I mean, it strikes me that, we're all standing in a group here and we're all men of a certain age.
Yes, unfortunately, we had a couple of youngsters who joined us to begin with and they couldn't keep up. And no, I don't mean that in terms of energy. I meant they just couldn't physically get to do some of the project work because of work commitments.
I see.
In future, if there's a funding development like this...
I thought that was a Youth of Today comment.
No, not at all. No. When they were there, they were really good and still are good. The problem is they can't get time off work. So when you look at funding in the future, we need to think a way of recompensing them for loss of earnings or something to get them out, to get them... Because they're the next generation. They need to learn this. They need to be looking after everything we have.
This is going to be new information coming in, Richard. It's potentially extremely useful. How are you going to be... how are you going to be disseminating the information? Who will have access to it? Who will be able to use it?
Well, eventually, we'll be publishing material. There are umpteen different ways we can do that. The Eco Museum itself runs a website, and so we can actually put on documentation, describe our interpretations there. We have plans for creating guided walks so that people with mobile phones can follow in our footsteps, if you like, but just look at a landscape that isn't there anymore. Some of the stuff we're producing is entirely new, and that's really exciting.
Richard Tippin there, Christopher Dingwall, and volunteer Gordon Miller.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that there seems to be no documented evidence of this? Because I'm guessing it must have happened elsewhere as well.
Must have done. Must have done. But again, we were just discussing this. Years ago, I went to the library in Kirkintilloch, and they had a map section there. This was the old library. And there was heaps of stuff. There was lots of big hospital complexes around about that area for some reason. I'm not sure why. But because there was hospitals, they needed a laundry. There was a huge, massive industrial complex, the Vedanda Laundry. Now, this would have been probably extant during the First World War. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a single piece of evidence of its existence anymore.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you go down to Dumfries and Galloway, where they used to create, there was a massive explosives factory there along the Solway Firth and what have you. This complex was 9 miles long. 9 miles long, and the only evidence of its existence nowadays, well, two of these things, there's a museum, which is obviously built since, but there's one chimney breast.
Wow.
That's it.
Yeah, that's all that exists.
That's all that exists.
So whatever they come up with on Marl will become kind of probably the first piece of proper documented evidence that we have on this, which is fascinating, actually. I do wonder if it's been done in other places. It probably has been.
Almost without a doubt.
Yeah.
But again, it is not something I have heard of. Yeah. You know, but anyway, coming up, it's Climate Week Northeast. We have a station renovation, and that actually sounds quite promising.
It is, yeah, in Blair Athol. Beautiful railway station there, actually. Uh-huh. Really quite picturesque, mm-hmm. but there are not many trains stop there now.
No, unfortunately. And what do? If you come across an injured bird or an animal by the side of the road?
Plus, of course, we've got this morning's mystery sound.
Craig in Bearsden thinks it might be a puffin.
Davey from Annisland thinks it's Ronnie Corbett's budgie.
This is anonymous. That sounds suspiciously like my knees and hips on this morning's dug walk. Lovely morning here in Tara, looking across the Devon to Forglen House.
Oh, that's a bonny view. Is the mystery sound a coot, says Heather from Linlithgow.
And is there another one there?
Aye, Davey G.
He says, it sounds like what my partner Joe and I refer to when we're not sure what it is as a duck-type thing. Not to be confused with a CTT, which is a crow-type thing.
Oh, very good, yeah, very good. Get in touch, outofdoors at bbc.co.uk. You can text us 80295 or give us a call on 0808 592 9500.
We're going to stand the natural order of things in its head now, because obviously this is an outdoor programme about the outdoors, and we spend a lot of time outdoors, but what if you couldn't go outdoors?
I know. Just bear with us here. That's what the children involved in a new project with the Cromer Future Group in Aberdeenshire have been contemplating. Now, they've created a model colony depicting what life could be like on Mars 100 years from now, complete with very clever ideas on how to bring the outdoors inside.
I'm Harvey. Welcome to our Mars project, where we are designing and making the first big Mars colony.
Let's go through the door. I'll follow you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We hope you have had a safe and comfortable journey from Earth.
Okay. We're trying to show all the intricate details of the Mars base and also just how big it is and how many different parts there are. And there's these kind of big domes on the surface with tunnels connecting each dome so that people can move around and things can move around and all sorts of different stuff happens in each different dome. So they've each got a different kind of purpose that they're used for. And then there's also the living area, which is kind of designed to be as nice towards the people as possible and kind of remind them a bit of Earth, because it's got trees and grass and lots of other kind of things that might help them feel more at home on Mars.
I'm Leslie Ellis. I'm one of the trustees of Cromer Future Group. The whole thinking about going to Mars is to set something 100 years in the future and get the children to think about what does that actually mean? What would it look like? Both in terms of the facilities you'd need to stay alive, but also what would it be like to live somewhere where you could never go outside, take your helmet off and feel the wind in your hair or feel the rain on your face. How can we compensate for that? Because it's a very unnatural thing. Mars is a brutal place. Its surface is washed with solar radiation. It's dangerous. So mostly the plans are that they may live underground in a lava tube. That's a dark, black place. So how do we ensure that people find it acceptable? And I think the key to that is providing them with opportunities to feel like they can go outside, they can be somewhere more natural. I think when the astronauts are in the space station, they take recordings of natural sounds to listen to because it's the thing they miss most. And that's why we've built that concept into what we do here.
Give me sort of a practical rundown of how you create the outdoors indoors.
I think we've allowed the youngsters to look at it and decide what they wanted to put in. One of them, I think, has already said to you that they wanted a heritage park. So we have an area of natural woodland, all in a dome, and it's somewhere that is as natural as you can make it. They also wanted a park, you know, somewhere where they could have a play park, and wanted a little stream running through it. So the designs have all been done by the youngsters. They put in a boating lake and they put in a fountain. But it's not easy. Every dome has to be separate so that in the event there's a problem, you can actually isolate that area and deal with it. And that's the thing that is so different to on Earth. You have to think about staying alive all the time.
I'm Imogen Paul, and I'm also one of the trustees of Cromar Future Group.
How engaged are the young people with this? I mean, this is all of their handiwork, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing what they've done. It's an incredible amount of work, and the detail is magnificent. The imagination that these children have when they've understood what's necessary to put in the model, and they've understood the background behind the Mars colony, they've just let their imagination go. And it's a lovely mixture, I think, of science and imagination and creativity.
And made them think.
It has made them very much think what's important and all the problems that you would have if you were trying to put a colony on an alien planet like Mars, and the things that you wouldn't have, the things that you would lose if you have to leave Earth behind.
Yeah, the outdoors.
The outdoors, the freedom of being able to go outside, the range of animals and plants that we have on Earth that you wouldn't be able to recreate in the underground tunnels in Mars.
My name is Eliza. I love the outside. It's really nice to go outside, especially when it's sunny. And I just want to try and recreate it in lava tubes. And lava tubes are massive, big black holes, really.
And can you imagine what it would be like living in one of them?
Scary, for me, really. Probably kind of depressing, because you'd never be able to be like, oh, I can go lie in the sun for a bit or go play on the swing or something. It's just like black, 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 and you're not allowed outside because it would probably kill you.
I'm Milo, and it certainly taught me a lot more about Mars. Like, I never knew the sunsets were blue or the temperature could reach minus 169 degrees centigrade.
Yeah, like, do you fancy living there?
I mean, I don't know if I fancy living there. I kind of prefer Earth.
One of the kids said that because of the gravity difference on Mars, you lose your muscle mass. It'd be very difficult. Once you've been on Mars for many years, it's very difficult to then get back to Earth because your muscles would have wasted away so much, you wouldn't be able to walk around on Earth very well. And that was really quite upsetting for them to think that they wouldn't be able to get back to that connection of the environment on Earth. The outside environment on Earth was very important to them. Imagine if your Earth was such an awful environment that you had to leave to go to Mars. Perhaps you couldn't get back to Earth because you had destroyed the planet. The planet you weren't able to live on the planet anymore. Then that would be such a shame if you don't look after your planet well enough. So that was one of quite a reminder that we need to look after our planet.
And you can enjoy the Welcome to Mars experience for yourself by stepping inside Beacon Base this weekend at the Tornaveen Hall. You need to book your tickets in advance, and there is a link to that on our website. What a clever bunch of kids.
Yes, no, absolutely. It's interesting, that kind of sort of, well, I was about to say blue sky thinking, presumably red sky thinking if it's on Mars, but it...
Blue sunset,
indeed. You know, but if you actually sit yourself down and think, how would you absolutely be able to do this? What would I be looking for if I were in that situation?
Yeah, well, they wanted to see animals. And, I mean, that would be very challenging to have animals. And they were talking about, you know, could you take DNA there?
Well, so almost have a sort of library of DNA.
Yeah. It really did make them think. It's a very clever idea.
Yeah, too straight. The Cromer Future Group are also hosting events as part of Northeast Climate Week, which is happening right here, right now. And joining us to tell more about that is Alison Stewart from the organisers, Northeast Scotland Climate Action Network. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning.
What exactly is Climate Week Northeast? How did it get started?
Well, Climate Week Northeast is 10 days of amazing events throughout Aberdeen City and Aberdeenshire, ranging from beach cleans to talks from academics, you name it, we've probably got it in there. It is all about really, we used to be about raising awareness, but now actually most people are aware of climate change. It's really about prompting action so people understand what they can do to really take action on climate change. And it came about 10 years ago, so it's our 10-year anniversary this year, which is quite amazing, I think. And Aberdeen Climate Action started it, and we started it because there was a real need for it. At that point, nobody really was talking about climate change here in this region, and there was quite a lot of resistance against it. So we started it up to really group together those people who were taking action to show how the general public could take action and really get the conversation started. And we were kind of, we joined up with a sustainability group that was in existence at that time, chaired by Aberdeen City Council, and just kind of took it over and radicalised it and made it wider than Aberdeen to Aberdeenshire, and brought in tons of different partners, ranging from the universities to the NHS to the arts centres, to just well-known charities alongside community groups and people doing things on the ground.
It is easy to feel a bit hopeless, I think, when you think about climate change, because it's such a massive issue. How important is it that we kind of remain positive about it?
Oh, it's extremely, extremely important. That's the only real way of getting people to take action. Because when you start the doom and gloom, people just switch off. They just think it's overwhelming. So really, you've got to look at this as an opportunity. We have a huge opportunity to change our society, our communities for the better. You know, when we're talking about climate action, we're talking about things that help reduce poverty, that can help reduce inequalities, that can help with our health. So, you know, we're talking about what I can do as a person in maybe insulating my house. Well, that will drive down my energy bills. It will help the planet by reducing energy demand, carbon use, and it will also help my health as well. You know, same with cycling or walking. You know, what's better than getting out in the fresh air and having some exercise, really? It really helps lift your mood as well as your fitness, and reduce the bill of the NHS as well. So all these things that I can do are actually really beneficial in many different ways. But also as a society, you know, when groups come together to do really amazing community climate action projects, you're building that community and you're building that resilience and that hope within the community as well.
The fact that this is essentially centred around about the oil capital of Europe, does that help, or is it the resistance to this still?
No, actually, I think it helps. I think that...
In what way?
Well, because so many people in this area obviously are involved intimately in the oil and gas industry, whether they're a part of it, you know, as in one of their family members is actually working in the oil and gas industry, or they're reliant on some way because they're a restaurant or something like that. But there's a residual guilt. People know and understand at this point. It was different 10 years ago, but they do know about climate change now and they want to do something about it. And where they're not enabled to do that through lack of leadership from our government, they really now are taking the step themselves grassroots. You know, unfortunately, there's still an awful lot of barriers to real difference in our society, though. We need the UK government to put down targets for reduction for oil and gas production that will really drive a transition.
Do those need to be legally binding?
Yes, without a doubt. You know, really, that's what the oil and gas companies are almost waiting for, because without those, they can't, they're kind of banged. You know, the whole point and premise of our community, of our company law, of capitalist society, is that companies are there to make profit for their shareholders. So if they can, if the most profitable way still is oil and gas, then they're almost bound to do that. So the government needs to show that it isn't there, the future is not fossil fuels, and show it in a really meaningful way by putting down, draw down, you know, this is the reduction targets for this sector.
If there needs to be big societal changes to really make an impact, is there a danger that individuals can just feel that they're tinkering around the edges of it and what they do will make very little difference, really?
Yes, and that's it. You know, once people understand about climate change, they can really get eco-anxiety if they can't take action, which is why we're doing Climate Week Northeast, to really show people what they can do. But also that is the whole point of NESCAN Hub and the other regional community climate action hubs throughout Scotland. We're really there to help people to take action themselves and not only do community climate action projects and change their own lives, but also to actually do plans for their community to really drive change. And really start to be engaged in the decision-making processes around our transition to enable it to be a just transition, not just simply a transition driven by vested interests and the economy.
I've frequently heard the argument, yes, but, you know, we couldn't pull the plug on oil and gas just now, we couldn't pull the plug on carbon fuels because we just couldn't cope, you know, I'm moving from that at the moment. And I accept the fact that's absolutely true, but surely you have to start at some stage, you know, to make meaningful movements towards that point.
Yes, I mean, quite frankly, the reason why we're in a situation of dependency upon oil and gas is because of the oil and gas industry's lobbying and the fact that our government hasn't really acted to put in place the right investment and subsidies for renewables and other alternatives. But you know what? We actually have a vast amount of we've got all the technology we really need to go fossil free. We just need the political will and the financing and the determination behind that. But you know, communities, if they're given support, can do so much themselves. And with the right regulations in place for house builders, for packaging, for all these things that actually we need government to take a lead on, we really would be, as a society, enabled to make the changes that we do want to see.
So events are happening all this week then, Alison. Any particular highlight for you?
Well, I'm going to the Green Family Fun Day in a matter of hours at Hayslade Park. We've got tons of stalls and activities for people. And we can talk and play games and really get some more knowledge about climate change and what they can do. So that's 11 till 3 there. Up in the Shire, in Bankery, the barn are doing a seed potato day and growing day. We've got Bob from 1C4 doing lots of seed potato days throughout the week. We've got the RSPB doing some amazing stuff at Balmeedy Beach. We've got Scottish Rural College doing talks. We've got RGU and the University of Aberdeen doing cycling and health talks and a big energy panel. So if you're interested in that, then pop along to University of Aberdeen with that. We've got the APA doing tons of stuff at the Lemon Tree. We've got Aberdeen City Council and Shire Council doing loads of different stuff in the libraries, like junk sculptures and swap shops and things like that. We have Seafine doing stands. We've got climate-friendly, positive farming tours at Glen Sock through the James Hutton Institute.
You're being very naughty here. You're basically just reading out everything that's happening for the next week.
Sorry, Kevin.
It's worth a try. But listen, Alison, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That was kind of you.
No worries. And come along to Climate Week North East.
All right, thank you. Turns out the BBC is actually hosting an event as part of Climate Week here in Aberdeen. It's all about broadcasting the environment, and you can find details of that and all the other events on the North East Climate Week website. There's a link on our page. Right, let's move on to an item now that apparently, and not that I've been here, has caused most discussion in the office this week, rats. And as I understand it, they won't get much in the way of love from the production team.
Absolutely none. None of us were leaping to their defence. And I think just now I'm going to be virtually climbing the wall here because this is going to give me the heebie-jeebies. You've had a recent experience with rats and how to deal with these unwanted visitors.
I am a rat. So are you, if you were born in 1960, or 1948, or 1972. Just keep on adding or subtracting 12 years to any of those numbers to come up with the years of the rat, according to the Chinese zodiac. Now, us rats are supposed to be cunning and witty and prosperous, and I can only speak for myself here, but something somewhere has gone seriously wrong with that last one. Rats have been very much on our minds lately in the Stephen household as stuff has started to go missing from our tack room. Mostly things like carrots and apples. But feed bags had been chewed open. We wondered, but we weren't sure. The crunch point came when my wife found what she thought were rat droppings in one of the stables. Cue a call to our local pest control firm, Presley's. Now, Alan Wallace is one of their team, and when he came round, I asked him, when you get a call out like this, what's the first thing you do?
You would do an initial survey of walking around, looking for burrows, droppings. Rats' teeth, they're always growing, so they're always looking to sharpen their teeth. So you're looking for chew marks on timbers, pallets. You'll end up with a crescent-shaped. So as opposed to the rest of the wood on a pallet that's really dirty, you'll end up with a nice clean bit of timber where the rats have been chewing the timbers.
That trap was outside one of the stables, and it wasn't that my wife pointed it out. I realised that there are actually, there's a wee chew mark down in the bottom there. It's been using that as a run.
So that's why I put the box outside, so rats will, if they can, stick to a wall line, because then they've only got 180 degrees of potential danger.
Yeah.
So they'll stick to the wall line. They have hairs on their back that they use to mark out their routes, and they remember the routes. If they come across something that's new, they're very wary of it because they're neophobic, is the phrase. They don't like new stuff, but we'll always put boxes down because if the rat is new to the site, then potentially everything's new. But if there's a food source in that trap in the box and the other food has been removed, then there's a good chance it will take it.
Our rat was a brown rat. Rattus norvegicus, much, much bigger than a mouse. Large ears, eyes that can swivel independently so they can look out from predation from above, and really long tails. Their tails feature a handy escape mechanism. If something grabs a rat by its tail, it degloves, it sloughs off its outer skin, and hey presto, ratty is offski. You hear people saying that rats are clean animals. Well, yes and no. Domestic rats are extremely clean, fastidious in fact. Wild rats, not so much. Any animal that can, and occasionally does, crawl up through your toilet bowl really can't be too fussy. Rats also carry a host of zoonotic diseases, stuff that we can catch, like leptospirosis, hantavirus, and here in the UK, a type of meningitis. The idea that rats, or rather rat fleas, were responsible for the Black Death is now being seriously questioned by academics. The bubonic plague, celebrated in the nursery rhyme Ring a Ring of Roses, did indeed devastate the population of Europe and Asia back in the 14th century, but rats may not have been the main cause. The current thinking is that it was probably us, human-to-human transmission, and that's why half the population, an estimated 75 million people, all fell down and never ever got back up again. I didn't know this, but male rats are called bucks and unmated females does. Pregnant females are dams, and baby rats are known as kittens or pups. Now, one pregnant adult female rat is capable of producing an awful lot of kittens or pups. Assuming an average gestation period, just 3 weeks, an average litter size, we'll call it 15, and that all the offspring would survive, which is a bit of a stretch because in the real world they wouldn't, you could go from one rat on day one to about 12,000 by the end of the year. Now, clearly, that kind of success can cause problems. When we visited St Kilda a few years ago, an archipelago which is hoaching with seabirds, we were told that when the landing craft occasionally comes up onto the beach in Village Bay, its lowered ramp is surrounded by a semicircle of volunteers, all watching intently to check that no stowaway rat sneaks off and makes it onto the main island. Because rats and ground nesting birds really don't mix. So major efforts have been made to eradicate the rodents here in Scotland and the Sheehan's, but also further afield in places like New Zealand and the Falkland Islands. When they did the Falklands, the specialist team that went there flew in with a staggering 100 tonnes of rat poison. Now, that's impressive. But for sheer scale and enthusiasm, you've got to admire Alberta's approach to rat control. The Canadian province is the largest inhabited area on Earth, which is entirely rat-free, largely because when the rats first arrived there back in the 1950s, the local human population went nuts. They created a control zone, hundreds of kilometres long, and they used shotguns, bulldozers, high explosives, poison gas and napalm to try and control them. I think it's fair to say that the situation got a wee bit out of control and they dialed things back after several farm buildings were either blown up or burnt to the ground. Nowadays, they just use the rodenticide warfarin. It's much more effective, but I suspect a lot less fun. I'm going to leave the last word here to Alan Wallace from Presley Pest Control. And if you have a few hens or even hanging bird feeders for wild birds, you're probably not going to like this bit.
Where have I done somebody with chickens before, and I took one visit putting traps and baits down and went back 10 days later and took 14 carcasses out of his garden. So, and that was just a small garden with a dozen chickens.
We feed birds here. We've got peanuts out, we've got bird food out and what have you, and since we've become aware of the fact that there is a rat issue, I've been looking at that thinking, is there a better way of doing that? Don't know.
Again, it's a food source. What we would recommend is you feed your chickens, don't leave the feed out overnight. The same with birds. Yeah, everybody likes to feed the birds and see the birds, especially in the winter, but don't put too much out. Mm. If it's lying, don't have it all lying on the ground overnight, because that's a food source for them to come in. And once they find the food source, they will think,
happy
it's Christmas.
Alan Wallace there, pest controller.
Are you rat-free now?
Don't know. Don't know, the basically the trap and the baits will stay there for another couple of weeks. You know, there hasn't been anything else in the mechanical traps. Mm-hmm. So I honestly don't know. If they weren't destructive, I'd have been tempted to leave them alone.
Really?
Yeah.
A friend once sent me a picture.
I would have, my wife wouldn't.
No, absolutely, I'm with her. A picture of a bird feeder with a rat hanging off the side of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, friends of ours had exactly the same thing. It used to go up onto the table. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. But if there is a food source out there, as Alan said, they will come.
Yeah.
You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens. Sitting right next to me at Beech Grove, nursing her heebie-jeebies, is Rachel Stewart. to keep them warm. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is also available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you actually listen to this. Get in touch, which is what Kelly did. She says, Kia ora, I'm a big fan of the show and tune into the podcast regularly from my home in New Zealand. This is the closest I could find to Scottish scenery at home with less rain, no midges and warmer weather. All right, don't rub it in, Kelly. Says, I really enjoy about hearing some familiar places, plants and critters and some new ones. Your show's encouraged me to think globally about biodiversity and conservation. Your treasures are our trash.
Yeah, the landscape here is littered with rowan trees, which are widely considered a pest species. It's really interesting to learn about these species from their native home perspective. Perhaps there are lessons in there for us all. Thanks for a top quality show that can be enjoyed from the other side of the world. Noho ora mai, says Kelly. Right, time for our mystery sound again.
Got lots of suggestions here. Joy in Greenock thinks it might be a corncrake. And says, Kenny from Macduff says, I think the mystery sound is the gape signalling to its fellow daffs to hurry up and get on with opening.
I like that. Alison in Rossneath says, I think it's the sound of a puffin.
Sandyford in Lugas doesn't have a guest, but would like to report a crow at Turra with a lot of white feathers, often seen at Devon Road, Meadowview Junction. Your report has been accepted and noted, Sandy. Thank you.
Mark's heading out there any minute now.
Yeah.
Alistair, who's not in Elgin, says, good morning from a beautiful sunny morning in Valencia. Valencia, blah, blah, blah. The forecast.
See, there's no rain in Valencia.
I know.
Because the rain in Spain falls mainly on the
yeah,
plain.
Yeah, I like it, yes. Yeah,
and
you know
therefore
where this
it's
is
not
going.
A rusty red tin roof.
That's yeah, it, exactly. So. The forecast is just 23, he says.
Oh.
18 actually felt quite cool a couple of days ago. Our first visit, and it's a gem, great for walking. It's getting close to the end of the Fala Festival, which is literally involving smoke and flames. The mystery sound, is it fire and fireworks play a huge part of the festival? So, he can imagine sitting in my shed with a rusty red wrinkly tin roof listening through triple glazing to kids setting off small fireworks. Not even close. Shame, better luck next week.
Absolutely. Craig and Bearsden thought it might be a long-tailed tit. Alan and Pamela thought it might be a fulmar, as did Anne and Kirkwall Orkney. Mystery sound woodpecker. No, that was the woodpecker in the background, Margaret, for Dunfermline. No. Katie from Perth thought it might be a nightjar. Oh, look,
that's a good one.
This is a birthday boy. This is birthday boy Graham from Hove. I was up at 5:30 this morning, but cheated and listened on playback. So he was, in fact, listening in bed in breakfast.
Yep.
Love the programme. I've done for many years. Perfect start to the weekend. Many thanks.
I hope it was a good breakfast, given you're the birthday boy today. And Winnie says, my little son Peter thinks the mystery sound is a swan with his little ones. Good guesses. Get in touch if you still want to have a go. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email address. Text us 80295 or give us a ring on 08085 92 95 00. Now, what do you do if you see an injured animal lying at the side of the road? Well, you tend to go out and have a look, don't you?
Well, I usually check it. But yeah. And to be honest, I hate animals getting run over on the road. I hate them getting two-dimensional. So usually I'll pick it up and actually just put it into the side. It gives them a wee bit of dignity.
Well, a wildlife campaigner in the Highlands has put together a first response kit which can be carried in the boot of your car to give poorly animals the best chance of survival before they're taken to a rescue centre. Hannah Moneagle regularly rescues animals when she's out and about, and she unpacked the kit to show me the kinds of things she finds useful.
So what we've got here is just a little kind of backpack almost. And in here what you'll find, first of all, is there are some leaflets. And these guide you as to what is in the kit. So first of all, it's a little guidance note which explains that this is not a first aid kit. And it's not intended to be that. It is purely to give you the equipment to be able to take the initial steps towards helping an animal or bird that you might come across by securing it and then being able to transport it to your nearest wildlife rescue. So obviously we don't advocate you're trying to give first aid to an animal or a bird. You know, leave that to the professionals. That's basically the guidance that we give first and foremost. And then on the other side of our guidance note, there's a contents list, which sets out everything that's in the kit and what you might use it for.
Okay. So the kind of thing I can see here, you've got a high-vis vest, a torch, gloves, a blanket.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, we've got everything you might need to come across for your own safety, obviously, as well as that of the animal or bird that you might come across. And then we've got some more information. So we work in partnership with the Road Lab, which is a project run by a university in England, and they're trying to collate all the data about where wildlife roadkill occurs in the UK. So we pop one of their leaflets in. You can have a look at them on social media if you want more information, but there's a QR code on here to take you to their pages where you can report if you come across a dead animal or bird, and that will help them to document where this has happened and they can get a better picture of things. And then you'll come across something fairly hefty, which is the start of a little snow shovel, which comes apart into various pieces. So that could just be put together, and that can basically be used if you know, needed to move an animal or bird off a road and move them onto the side of the road, or if you perhaps wanted to use that to get them into a place of safety. So that's in there, just a collapsible snow shovel. And then we have a little mirror. Now, people might think that this is a strange addition to your kit, but basically what you can do with this is if you're not sure entirely if the animal or bird is still alive, then you can hold this up to their mouth and just see, obviously, if their breath hits the mirror, and you will then have a better understanding of perhaps whether they're still alive or not.
And that's quite a clever idea, isn't it? And that's something you feel passionately about, is that people don't just assume that the animal has died if they see it lying at the side of the road.
Absolutely. And that actually stemmed from a story that I read on Facebook from a wildlife rescue in England, where they had come across a badger lying beside a road, and they discovered that it had been lying there for about 4 or 5 days and was actually paralysed. So hadn't passed away, but had been lying there unable to move, you know, completely paralysed, and people were driving past it on a regular basis, and really it got to me. And I thought, you know, all it would have taken is for one person to stop and go, let's just double check this situation. They would have found that the badger was still alive, and they could have got the help much more quickly. And that's really the message that I would want to get across to people, is, you know, never assume that, you know, an animal is dead, and you know, always take the steps, if it's safe to do so, to check on it and see if you could help.
So what else have you got in here?
Right, we have got a wee net here, a telescopic net. Now this can be useful. Sometimes you might have a bat that needs to be collected, or a small bird, and then obviously you can just pick it up in the net and then collapse it again and pop that back into your wee kit. So we found that's quite useful.
So how did you get involved with this? Why did you decide to put this kit together?
So I used to volunteer in wildlife rescue, and I worked originally at the North East Wildlife and Animal Rescue Centre in Aberdeenshire, and I learned a tremendous amount from Keith and Pauline Marley that had the centre at that time. And what I used to do was I would go out, if there were reports of injured animals or birds, I would go out and collect them and take them back to the centre for treatment. And I found that I always had bits of kit rocking about in my car, bits and pieces, nothing terribly organised, and it suddenly occurred to me that I really needed to get on top of this and put something together that would be much more practical for myself. And then I realised after a bit of time that this didn't need to just help me, you know, it could help other people as well, and that perhaps there was, you know, something in making these kits publicly available.
And you still put your kit to good use, because you're now based in the Highlands and you still go out helping and transporting animals to rescue centres.
I do, yes. I mean, I'm on the roads quite a bit. I'm based just off the Black Isle, and we have lots of wildlife in these parts. And, you know, just recently I went out kind of in the middle of the night to look for a tawny owl that had been grounded by the side of a road, and went out looking for it in order to take it to one of our local rescue centres. Alas, we couldn't find it, but, you know, certainly the willingness is there to help whenever I can. And certainly I've removed an enormous number of animals off the roads so far this year, because part of it is also, for me, it's a dignity thing as well. You know, I hate to see an animal hit on the road and then you just gradually see them degrading and just left there on the carriageway. So if I come across a dead animal, like say, once I've double checked that it is definitely dead, then I move it to a more suitable place off the roads to give it a bit of dignity in death as well.
That's Hannah Moneagle and the kits of the backing of wildlife presenter Chris Packham. And Hannah hopes to make some more of them available soon, if you're interested in that.
You may remember a couple of weeks ago we heard about the restoration work being carried out on the Discovery in Dundee. Well, the Scottish Boat Building School, based in Irvine and Ayrshire, has been involved in helping with some of the planning for that work. They have an excellent workshop there, and to be honest, I was like a kid in a sweet shop as Conor Campbell showed me round.
Scottish Boat Building School came about in 2014 with the idea in mind to try and preserve traditional boat building skills and try and keep them alive through the training of new trainees and hopefully the introduction of our apprenticeship scheme, which we've now successfully managed to get up and running.
How did you get involved with it?
So I came on as a technical assistant with the Scottish Maritime Museum in 2012. Back then it was just the maintenance unit, or the maintenance yard for the museum vessels that would come over and get some work done. My boss at the time was then brought in to start up the boat building school in 2014, and I moved on to that through the pre-apprenticeship programme.
I would say, in all undue modesty, I'm a reasonably competent carpenter when it comes to sort of right angles and things like that.
Yes.
You know, I can cobble it together, no great problem at all. What I couldn't do is the kind of sort of shapes and compound curves that yes. are necessary here.
Yeah, so that's the big difference between traditional joinery and carpentry work and boat building, is when you're making things for boats, you have to put into consideration that the hulls aren't flat. Most things aren't right degree, 90 degree angles and things, so you've got to have consideration for the curvature of the hull in both directions, in the horizontal and the vertical planes. The lengths of timber, the type of timber that you're going to use and things like that. So there's a lot more you have to think about when it comes to joinery and boat building.
We passed a joint here that frankly I'd never seen before. What is this?
So yeah, so this is called a Jupiter scarf joint or a step scarf joint as well. As
immediately half our listenership is glazing over and I don't care. I'm finding this fascinating. Carry on. So how does it work?
So the idea is it's a step scarf joint. In basic terms, if you think of taking two wedges and turning them opposite to each other so it creates a one solid piece of timber, that's a scarf joint. The step scarf joint is designed that it has a notch in the middle, so the middle of the wedges lock together and that holds them in place. But with these ones at the ends of each of the wedges, they have a 45 degree angle cut that locks the end of the wedge into the piece of wood, and the notch in the middle for the wedge or the peg is designed to force the ends tight against each other, and that locks the full joint in place.
Can we go back through this? Just there's like sort of plastic sheeting here to stop. There we go. We come through here because I spotted those up on the wall. What are those?
So they are three-stage canoes that were built a few years back now at this point for the BBC that were recreating the Canoe Boys Journey. So they're Loch Abber canoes, which are a three-stage canoe design. Each section of the canoe is a sealed compartment that is held together through a steel cable that runs from the forward section of the middle compartment along the bow underneath the boat and runs through a channel that runs all the way through up to the aft of the boat, comes back up over the stern and attaches onto the other end.
Effectively, it is a canoe that is strung together like a bow.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. That's probably a good way to describe it. So it's designed with ease of use in mind. You can take them apart and throw them in the back of the car and take it to where you're going and then assemble it when you get there type thing.
But you must, you know, over the years of this school, get presented with all sorts of different kinds of boats, all sorts of different kinds of problems. I understand that you are consulting on the Discovery in Dundee.
Yes, so that's another quite interesting thing. So the benefit of the boat building school being part of the museum is we do quite a lot of restoration work and preservation work as well. So when things like the Discovery restoration comes in, we are in quite a good position to offer support, whether it's through just discussing possible restoration works or providing what we're currently doing, which is providing demonstration joint pieces. So the Jupiter scarf or the step scarf that I was just mentioning about, that's a demonstration piece for something that they're going to be doing on a much bigger scale for the Discovery itself.
Yeah. So effectively, you kind of do a half-scale model and say, do that, boys, but bigger.
Yeah, essentially, we do the easy work, and then they'll be the ones doing all the difficult things, essentially.
Well, I was on the Discovery a few weeks ago, and they've got their work cut out. Some of those timbers are red rotten.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, restoration work, I've never done anything to that scale. The restoration work I've done in the past, it's amazing. You look at a boat that big, or any boat, really, that you're going to do restoration work on, and you don't really know what you're going to find until you start digging through it.
You set up the school, the boat building school here, basically to try and maintain those skills, etc., and to get apprentices through and the like. Has it worked?
Yeah, I feel like it's worked. We haven't had a huge number of people through. I think all in all, in total now, we've had 4 fully trained apprentices that have came and went. But from traineeships themselves, we've had somewhere from 20 to 30 trainees come in over the years. And we're now starting to work more with local councils to bring in volunteers and traineeship programmes through them as well.
Do you know when somebody, somebody's got power tools going next door, do you know when somebody walks through the door whether they've got the knack or not? I think it's something to do with the smell of sawdust in your blood.
Yeah, I mean, you get little things here and there, but we've had trainees that have come in and they don't really know too much about woodworking. You show them the basics of the joint work and then you see their final work and it almost puts you to shame sometimes. So there's been quite a few people that have came in over the years that have just had a knack for it, really. They've never done it before, but they just pick it up really quickly and they can run with it and they know what they're doing.
But, you know, if you train as a cabinet maker, say,
Yes.
You know, that's fine. You know, you can put together lovely joints, you can put together a lovely surface, you know how to finish things off and things. But a sideboard isn't going to sink underneath you, and a boat very well might if you get it wrong.
Yeah, definitely. So with boat building, obviously, you've got that to take into consideration, that what you're building and what you're working on at the end of the day is designed to go in water. So you've got to consider that things like that have got to float. So there's a lot more you need to think about when it comes to that. So it adds a little bit of stress.
Well, wood itself is not a living material, and a boat is not a living thing, but they behave as if they are. You know, it will absorb moisture, it'll flex, it'll shape. It's, you know, and it, having the feel for that must take years and years and
yeah,
years.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even class myself as a master at it yet, and I've been doing it for 12 years. You learn more about wood the more you do it. All the different types of wood have different reactions to the way they move and the way they react to moisture, heat, cold. So there's a lot of things you've got to take into consideration when you're doing woodworking, whether it be in boat building or even cabinetry making as well, has that as well. You need to think about it. So when you're making tabletops, for example, you need to know how the wood's going to react when it dries out or things like that. But yeah, it's a bit of a different scale when it comes to boat building in that regard.
Connor Campbell, technical assistant at the Scottish Boat Building School there. We've got a car alarm going off in the background there, sorry.
Yeah.
It's not ours.
Not ours, yeah. I have to say, we're actually sitting in the sunshine.
Aye.
I mean, it's freezing.
First time it's freezing, but it's first time this year.
Ah, it's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's probably what set the car alarm off.
It could be. Now, plans are underway to save the historic and picturesque Blairattle Station House building in Highland Perthshire. Have you been there?
Yes.
Yeah, it's really nice, isn't it? A group of volunteers already look after the site because they're a bunch who've officially adopted it from ScotRail. You'll remember that scheme started a few years ago. And now they just want to basically raise its profile in the local community. They've recently been awarded some money from the National Lottery Heritage Fund to compile an oral history project, basically to tell the story of the role the railway has played in the village. I met up with Mike Shanto and Viv Cree on the platform.
There's been a station here since 1863, when the railway line from Perth to Inverness opened for the first time. The station building that we're working to try to save, it was actually completed in 1869, so it's a few years later. The station has had some very important and famous visitors, one of them being...
I know what you're going to say, Queen Victoria. It's always Queen Victoria.
So Queen Victoria visited the station 5 days after the station opened, and she was going to see the Duke of Atholl, who was a personal friend of hers, and he was dying at Blair Castle at that time. So there's lots of stories of Queen Victoria in the area long before this, but that was really the beginning of an important part of the story of the station, because what really happened from the years on was Blairattle, which was obviously never a railway village before, became very much a railway village, and a very important railway village thanks to an engine shed, which is over to our right here through the trees. The engine shed held two banking engines. People might wonder what a banking engine did.
Yes, explain that for us.
So the banking engine actually pushed the steam trains up and over Drumochter Pass. So if there hadn't been the banking engines and the engine shed, you wouldn't have had trains from Perth to Inverness.
So it became obviously pretty popular. As you say, you're on the Highland Main Line.
Yes, it was the most important station on the line because of the engine shed and the banking engines and everything that went with it. There was a time when 70 people were employed just simply at the station and the station alone. The engine shed worked night and day. It's really hard to imagine the activity that was around at the time, but... It was a very, very busy station and a very proud station. And without being competitive about it, we were actually a much more important station than Pitlochry.
So it was pretty busy up until the 1960s, and then there was a decline. What caused that?
One word, diesel. Now, I found it really interesting talking to people who remember the station and the story of the station. End of 1950s, into the 60s, diesel came and steam went, And because steam went, you didn't need the banking engines anymore. You didn't need the engine shed anymore. And it was the beginning of the end, really. Everybody knows about the beaching cuts in the 1960s. Obviously, Blairattle Station was saved, but Struan Station and Killiecrankie Station, which were the two stations either side of it, were not. They closed. And really, the larger story of the railway line became a story of decline. In the 1960s, the Duke of Athol's private waiting room was demolished at Blairattle Station. So the station building we have today is an uneven building because it's lost one of its two wings, and the symmetry of the building has been lost. Then into the 70s, and you've got more car use and people using cars where they would have used trains. And then the A9, the new A9 being built and the village being bypassed. So you've really got a story of not just the village declining because of the railway, but actually the village gets a much quieter place across the board.
Mike, it's played a big part in your life. You say you were basically born here.
Yeah, I was here, and then my father was Canadian. My mother worked in the station, and they met and married. And I was in Canada from 1946 and came back in 52, and this was my playground. Because my grandfather was a ganger, he was a charge hand on the railway. And I was always up turning the engines on the turntable, pushing it with one hand. There was a lot of us played up here. And it was a very, very important place. It employed a lot of people. The school was full of people. We had a lot of businesses here because of the railway as well.
And you witnessed its decline, of course.
I did. I went to, as Viv was saying, it was steam trains I went to. It was the 10 to 9 train to Pitlochry School. When we were finished at the primary school here, we went to Pitlochry. And it was a steam train. And it was great fun. And then I was still going to Pitlochry School when the first diesel came in, and we hated it. All of us hated it. It was like sitting in a bus sort of thing then. And it just the atmosphere wasn't the same. The smell was the same. None of us liked it.
You've adopted the station house.
Yes, we adopted the station under the ScotRail's Adopt a Station scheme at the beginning of 2023. And what that meant, first of all, was looking after the plants, the planters, a community notice board, just basically
keeping
everything clean. We pick up litter, we do all manner of things just to keep it nice for visitors and for travellers. The oral history project is really phase one of the business of taking forward the renovation of the station. We hope that phase one will engage people in talking about the station and getting involved in thinking about the stories of the station with a view to actually looking about what we want to do next with the station.
So this is trying to tell the future generation about the history of the station.
Yes, I think the station project encourages conversations not just about the past, but about the future and what do we actually want for the future. Phase two will be a feasibility study to work out just what does the community and the visitors alike, what do they want the station to be used for? And then phase three becomes something which will probably cost £500,000 plus, which is the doing up of the station. And we'll only do phase three if phase two tells us it's feasible. And that for us is really important to think about what is sustainable long term, because there's absolutely no point in raising £500,000 of public money to do up a building which then doesn't wash its face. And it's important that we understand that and that those who are working with us do as well.
That's Viv Cree and Mike Shanto from the Friends of Blairattle Station. Part of this project actually involves every child in the village receiving a book which will tell Mike's story in connection with the railway, which is really nice.
It's a nice idea. Mm-hmm. Time now to reveal our mystery sound for this week. Let's have a final listen.
I've got some wrong answers before we do the big reveal. Sarah in Inverness says it's a rat. Stuart from Elgin is listening in France. The mystery sound, I think, is a ptarmigan. Derek Robertson from Dundee also thinks it's a ptarmigan. And John Quinn, rats. Stuart in Glasgow, Capper Cayley. And Duncan, who's walking the dogs, thinks it's a grouse at a lick.
Good guesses, none of them right.
None of them correct. These are correct answers, however, because the correct answer is it's male toads breeding calls. And the first one came in was from Andrew Barry, Roman Camp, Broxburn. And then Nicola from Ochtamuchty says, we've just seen our first frog spawn on our ponds, and along with roads, they are toads, they are croaking away. What lascivious scenes. Steady,
oh,
Nicola,
nice.
Steady.
I actually saw frog spawn this week as well.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's not bad at all. Vicky listening in Ben Kinghorn got the correct answer. She's off to Kirkcaldy later to buy school shoes. A bit young to be listening to this programme, but never mind. I suspect it's not for her. Doogie and Anion Cooper, call us Spawny if you like, but the sound this week is toads calling away in their mating frenzy.
Ah, very nice. You've got all the answers, where
have I? Well, you have some as well. There you go. I've got that for.
Okay. Norma from Ardiseer also knows that it's, she says it's a frog. The heron who comes to our pond knows this sound too, mm-hmm. I bet. Lindsay from Kirkmichael again thinks it's a frog. It's actually a toad though, isn't it? Just
it
to
is
be clear.
It is,
yeah.
A toad.
And Geography Girl in Torfinns, good morning. Thank you for the positivity about the weather and the daylight report. They may convince me to leave my bed by 9 a.m. Is the mystery sound a lovesick frog? Because it's about time for fog spawn.
That, sadly, is just about all we've got time for this morning. Don't forget our new Scotland Outdoors podcast available today at noon, and our midweek podcast on Wednesday features a musical project from the ground. I can't speak. Thanks for listening.